Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for showing up. I'm glad you're here. How are you? How's your week been? Have you done anything interesting or cool? Have you had a bad time or a good time? Did you flip any situations from being something that might be uncomfortable or difficult to hold? Did you turn any of those sort of situations into a learning opportunity or a moment for growth? I know it can be difficult sometimes to live our lives. And I've had quite a few trials and tribulations that I've had to persevere through over the last couple weeks. Primarily everywhere, not even just in personal or work life. Work's been difficult, you know, just rough summary of what's been going on in my life. I had a lot of people quit, and then a new hire didn't show up, so I've got beyond a skeleton crew. And just learning how to go backwards, with the expectations of continuing forwards, whatever that means. There's always a motion forward, whether we want to call it time or entropy or chaos, you know? But we also have our own internal feelings about our own growth and our own trajectory. And often I don't feel that these things align with reality, if that makes any sense. So I think it was in some commentary on Taoism or perhaps Buddhism, but some sort of Eastern thought. They have two words for law, and I can't remember what they are. I think one of them's Li, but I don't remember which one. So don't quote me. I'm not a perfect source. But basically, there's natural law, which is the law of nature, you know, and nature has certain expectable outcomes and phenomena. When we drop something, we expect things to fall, and this is the law of gravity or whatever. And, you know, there's cause and effect. And so there's things that seem to exist outside the human brain that consistently continue, and we can observe these things. You know, but then we also have our ethics, we have our morals, we have the law for ourselves on what we think ought to be done, and we write these things down, and then we societalize in order to get along, you know? And those things might be slightly divorced from physical, empirical, scientific situations. Now, I want to compound that even further, because in my own personal belief system, I think that separation from the natural order, the natural world, is impossible. And from that abstraction, when we start to think about our choices, every single choice that can be made exists in nature. Now, what is nature? You know, I know I've talked about this on the show, so this might be even more of a refresher course. But when we talk about anything, any idea, whenever we philosophize or we get together or we try to investigate something, it's really important that we know what we're talking about. And so, what is nature? And I'm currently reading through this book by this dude named John Stuart Mill. And he was a utilitarian, and I have a couple other episodes about him. But I'm reading his essay on nature right now, and he has three definitions for it. The first definition for nature would be anything that happens, which is it. That's how I would define it. That's how I would see it. Anything that's happening, that's natural. Every separate facet of reality being seen in totality, the totality of all the differences and all the vagueness. That's nature, you know? And being part of reality, it's impossible to separate ourselves from it in any way, shape, or form. So his second definition for nature is anything that happens without human intervention, which is in complete contrast to the first definition, which I encourage. And I disagree, you know? And you see it in drugs a lot because people have this crazy concept of what is good for their body or not, and a natural drug is considered to be so much better than an artificial drug. You know, and like two of my favorite drugs are LSD and psilocybin, where psilocybin is natural and organic and comes from an organism that uses its own chemical processes to make something. Then LSD does not appear in nature. LSD is manufactured by humans. It is a derivative of a natural plant, and it exists in the world. But a lot of the times when people think of something that's fabricated by man, it cannot be, and it cannot have any connection to something that you could just walk upon. Now, if everything that we make and everything that we influence being part of nature creates more nature, and it becomes an expression of our nature, now, consider art. And last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, or at some point, I was talking about Plato's idea of imitations and these imitation games. And Plato had an idea for a perfect society, you know? And in this society, he thought that there should be no poets and there should be no art. And if it was being produced, it should be carefully considered. And I don't agree with this. I think open expression, open art should be able, but he saw this imitation as a distance from the world. Whereas Stuart Mill, in his book and his essay on nature, which I'm just so fond of right now, it depicts art as an expression of nature and nature to some end. And what is an end? It's an idea. It's that reasoning element inside our humanity. Being able to picture something, being able to hypothesize an outcome. And when we do our science, we don't do science where we don't have expectations for an outcome. It would get way too expensive if we all did pointless science like that. Especially with how difficult it is to get funding now in this world, you know? So even when we're doing our science, we have this fabrication, this imitation, which might not be on paper, but it's a thought form dependent upon reality that reason has started to chunk together into a possibility. And that's exciting. That's what mankind seems to be here for, or womankind. It's not just man's world out there. But how could that ever be something separate from the world? You know, if we make a change in the world, if we have an impact in some facet, if we affect someone or something, even if it's just by being present, with no action involved, just being presently in a situation can change how the situation is played. Everybody's self-perception of their own part to play in the situation is intricately dependent upon you being there just because you are. And we're all here on this planet, in the universe. We are all living lives. Why make a situation where our life, singular, you know, is completely segmented away from all the other lives out there. And this is a feeling of isolation that is pregnant in this kind of life. And I think throughout large portions of human history, we had so many different rituals and, like, you know, not just like holidays, but like an actual observance of an importance, like the old harvest holidays where people would get together because the food was reaped and everyone was there to catch the benefit of being able to eat their fill. You know, not just a corporate holiday because it's just normalized now, where the kids have expectations to get gifts, money, or things, and some of them are not even expected to be home. You know, what about family? Like, once a week, me and my family typically gets together for a dinner on Sundays. And it's one of the most important times of my week. It heals me just being able to be with my loved ones. It's the sense of connection, because family is the idea of nature, the idea of that interdependence among beings. It's its closest example because it's the system of connections that we're born into. It's the first example of life, of reality, of the future, of what we're becoming. You know, it starts in the family, and then we grow our love and our compassion, I feel, to be able to see all of nature and all of reality and all of what is as part of our family. You know, I try to think of existence as my family. It doesn't even have to talk to me, as long as I can listen. I also recently started another book by this dude named Philip Caliplio? Oh my goodness gracious, I can't pronounce anything. I just started this one yesterday, so I apologize for that gross, whatever, I'm gonna try again. Philip Caliplio, I think he was Canadian or something. It sounds kind of French to me. But basically, he was a journalist who ended up in Japan during war times or during some sort of like peace agreement, some sort of something. And he was there journalizing some dispute that was there and was drawn to the monastic schools of Zen Buddhism there, where Zen is this breed of Buddhism that was taken out of India by this guy who may or may not have existed named Bodhidharma. Took it to China and then taught the first generation patriarch, which the patriarchs of Zen are these Chinese like ubermensches, these like super teachers, super gurus. And so some of these patriarchs are like Hu Ning and Hong Po and many others. But roughly 600 years after Bodhidharma brings Buddhism to China, where it mates with Taoism and creates Chon, it migrates to Japan, where Chon is turned into Zen. And then hundreds of years later, Zen Buddhism has a cultural explosion, but it's more of a fad, more than a respected discipline, in the West. And it's slowly died down, and religiosity is on the low, and secularism is on the rise here in my mother country of the United States. And so even though Buddhism is still a thing, and with the psychedelic renaissance coming up now, more people are talking about spiritualism and ideas of theocracy and philosophy like Buddhism. But so roughly 60 years ago, Philip goes there and he finds a Zen teacher. I don't remember the dude's name, but basically this book that I'm reading is a collection of his lectures from start to finish on his technique when it comes to training Zen and as a teacher, how to go about it. And one of the things that leapt out to me in the introduction was this part about saying, if you can't find a teacher, this is probably the best book to have in front of you to teach yourself. And I like that a lot. So the metaphor I want to share from this book is one that I read this morning, but it was about a teacher person who is confronted by this devotee who comes and asks him about Zen. And he asks, you know, if past and future do not matter, then can't we do anything we want in the present moment if it's all that ever is? And the teacher said, your idea of the present moment is tiny and minuscule. And he had a blackboard and he drew a little tiny dot on the blackboard. And then next to it, he drew another little tiny little dot right on the blackboard. And he drew a horizontal line going from top to bottom, or vertical, top to bottom, oh my God, horizontal left to right. So made a grid with this, with the dot in the middle of it, right? Can you picture it? Hopefully. And then the sage went and looked at him and he said, the sage's idea of the present moment encompasses all that ever is and ever will be. That line that goes from left to right is the beginning of everything and everything that ever was. And that line that goes to the forward is everything that ever will be. And then the vertical line top to bottom is the infinite space of everything in the universe. You know, for the awakened and the enlightened one, that is the present moment. And that shook me pretty hard. And I don't know if traditional waking consciousness can grasp the immensity of that connectivity. Like, I can kind of see the metaphor, but I'm still a philosophical infant, and it's hard for me to grasp some of these concepts. Like, there's a Hindu visualization technique where you're supposed to sit in lotus position and get comfy and start your breathing routines, and then in your heart, you're supposed to envision a thumb-sized little deity, a god, sitting in your heart's lotus or whatever. And then you imagine that being growing and growing until it encompasses your body, until its arms are in your arms. And then it grows past you into your room. And then it encompasses your whole apartment, and then your whole apartment complex, and then the city, and then the state, and then the world, and then the universe. And it's like you just imagine yourself swelling and encompassing everything. And it's sort of similar to this parable that I just shared. Trying to consider how everything is so intrinsically connected, like butterfly effect to the 1,000th degree. Indra's beads of shimmering grandeur reflecting all the other beads 1,000 infinite times in all the others. Words are such a poor vehicle to try to describe these things I'm trying to describe right now. But they're still my favorite one. And I think our symbols and our art and all the ways that we decide to express our viewpoint of the world, I think they're valid, beautiful, purposeful, and important. And I think they're very natural. I think our language, even though it can only get so close to describing quote-unquote truth. Like, you know, for math class, there's that graph, I can't remember, I think it was a quadratic equation, but when it gets close to zero, it just gets closer and closer and closer to zero, but it never actually hits zero. This kind of also reminds me of Zeno's marathon thought experiment, where if you have this dude, if he runs half the distance, if he always runs half the distance to his mark, he never actually gets to the finish. Because at some point you end up splitting hairs. So you have a football field and you're in half the football field, and then you have half the football field left, you're going to cut that one in half, you have a quarter, you're going to cut that one in half, you're going to have an eighth, but you never get to zero, right? And that's kind of how I see words. Like, it's an attempt, it's a valiant attempt, and I still think it's natural. I don't think it's a bastardization, and I would never cut it out of society like Plato would say to, because it's the best we have to try to get closer to expressing life. And expression is still worth it. And that's where I'm going to end on my rant today. I'm going to go grab a good book and do a couple quotes. But yeah, man, I'm befuddled today because I've been so caught up in just thinking about these acts of perception and thinking about how to just let be. It's so much easier just to do things and not have to consider doing them the whole time you're doing them. It's just like, that just gets so exhausting. Either way, thank you for being here. I'm so grateful that you exist and that you decided to give me your time today. You are a beautiful, lovely soul. You're going to have an immense impact on people around you. You're going to have a great life, difficulties and all. And everything that you did and do is purposefully built and natural because it's the one that you're in. And I'm glad we're all here together. All right, I'll be right back. First, I'm going to be reading from that book I was telling you about, John Stuart Mill. This is from his essays on religion, which the first essay is on nature. I'm very curious to see his connections between nature and religion. Here it goes. Nature, then, in this is its simplest acceptation, is a collective name for all facts, actual and possible, or to speak more accurately, a name for the mode, partly known to us and partly unknown, in which all things take place. For the world suggests not so much the multitudinous detail of the phenomena as the conception which might be formed of their manner of existence as a mental whole. By a mind possessing a complete knowledge of them, to which conception it is the aim of science to raise itself by successive steps of generalization from experience. Such, then, is a correct definition of the word nature. But this definition corresponds only to one of the senses of that ambiguous term. It is evidently inapplicable to some of the modes in which the word is familiarly employed. For example, it entirely conflicts with the common form of speech by which nature is opposed to art and natural to artificial. For in the sense of the word, nature, which has just been defined and which is the true scientific sense, art is as much nature as anything else, and everything which is artificial is natural. Art has no independent power of its own. Art is but the employment of the powers of nature for an end. Phenomena produced by human agency, no less than those which, as far as we are concerned, are spontaneous, depend on the properties of the elementary forces, or of the elementary substances and their compounds. The united powers of the whole human race could not create a new property of matter in general, or any one of its species. All right, this is me interjecting. That's arguable. We're getting into some weird scientific territory, and I think John Stuart Mill would have been intrigued by this. All right, now I'm continuing. We can only take advantage for our purpose of the properties which we find. A ship floats by the same laws of a specific gravity and equilibrium as a tree uprooted by the wind and blown into the water. The corn, which men raise for food, grows and produces its grain by the same laws of vegetation by which the wild rose and the mountain strawberry bring forth their flowers and their fruit. A house stands and holds together by the natural properties, the weight and cohesion of the materials which compose it. A steam engine works by the natural expansive force of the steam, exerting a pressure upon one part of a system of arrangement, which pressure, by the mechanical property of the lever, is transferred from that to another, where it raises the weight or removes the obstacle brought into connection with it. In these and all other artificial operations, the office of man is, as has often been remarked, a very limited one. It consists in moving things into certain places. We move objects, and by doing this, bring something into contact which we were separate, or separate others which were in contact. And by this simple change of place, natural forces previously dormant are called into action and produce the desired effect. Even the volition which designs, the intelligence which contrives, and the muscular force which executes these movements are themselves power of nature. And that's basically what I've been trying to talk about. Said much more eloquently. Yeah. He was pretty good. Next, I want to read just a little section of this book on Buddhism I was talking about. The words the Buddha uttered involuntarily at this time are recorded variously in the Buddhist scriptures. According to the Kigan, the Avatamsaka Sutra, at the moment of enlightenment, he spontaneously cried out, "Wonder of wonders! Intrinsically all living beings are Buddha, endowed with wisdom and virtue, but because of men's minds have become inverted through delusive thinking, they fail to perceive it." The first pronouncement of the Buddha seems to have been one of awe and astonishment. Yes, how truly marvelous that all human beings, whether clever or stupid, male or female, ugly or beautiful, are whole and complete just as they are. That is to say, the nature of every being is inherently without a flaw, perfect, no different from that of Amida or any other Buddha. The first declaration of Shakyamuni Buddha is also the ultimate conclusion of Buddhism. Yet man, restless and anxious, lives a half-crazed existence because his mind, heavily encrusted with delusion, is turned topsy-turvy. We need therefore to return to our original perfection, to see through the false image of self as incomplete and sinful and separate, and to wake up to our inherent purity and wholeness. Right, I don't want to go too much further because I'm just not very familiar with that one, but I see a lot of connections between Zazen perception and looking at life as being a part of it, being inside it, instead of being separate and having to be forceful and make changes. The Taoist precept of Wu Wei, an active action but not laziness, inattentive attention, paradox, an oxymoron. My favorite realm of confusion, where we can find the closeness to that idea of what truth may or may not be. Now that I've thoroughly confused myself, let's go find Odin. I'll let him sign you out, let him tell you a little bit about his day, and then we'll let you go. And hopefully, I hope you have just a wonderfully comfortable and productive week. Thank you for being here.
Hello, it's Ask O again.
How are you?
Very good.
You are yelling.
I did not understand why I'm yelling.
That's okay.
That's this. I don't know.
That's fine. What are you doing? Do you have any advice to give today? How do you live a good life?
Well, let's start with the normal childhood.
What is that?
So, if you're a child like me, you have to get through kindergarten, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade.
And what does that all mean? What's the most important part of all that?
Learning.
Okay. What is learning?
Well, learning. Let's look into it. So, learning. Journals, reading, doing math.
Okay. Do you enjoy doing those things?
Yes.
Is it easier to learn if you enjoy doing it?
Yes.
Would you say that's part of what learning's about, is enjoying it?
Yeah. The second part of a human's lifetime, being a teenager. Well, if you're a teenager, you had to study. Please don't mind that. It's just my friend. Just please. I'm sorry. Yep. So, start with the teenager life. Second, teenagers. So, you had to study and learn, and it's really hard to be a teenager.
Good thing you don't have to worry about that yet.
Yeah. The third part of a human's lifetime, being an adult.
Okay.
Getting a car, getting a driver license, getting your first job.
Isn't part of being an adult being in control of yourself?
Yes, you had to do. So you had to might buy your own house.
Mm-hmm.
You had to do your job. Can't ask your dad for money.
You can sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
I love you, buddy.
I love you.
Thank you for giving me your time.
Yeah.
Hope you have a good rest of your day, okay?
Okay, bye. Bye.